Ambassador John McDonald, thank you for everything you've done, sir.
Well, thank you very much. Welcome this afternoon, everybody, to this panel on social justice and humanitarian response. I'm also delighted to welcome my co-chair and her friend from Nigeria. It's nice to have two women on the panel. It's the first time this has happened so far in this conference, so we're pleased about that. Those of you who heard me speak yesterday know that I like to tell stories. So as an introduction to this panel, I'm going to tell a story about women. I arrived in Geneva, Switzerland in late 1974 as the new Deputy Director General of the International Labor Organization, the oldest of the specialized agencies in the UN system, whose focus, starting in the Treaty of Versailles, is to ensure that they represent the workers of the world. And my first meeting of the senior staff at the ILO, I was brought into a room in which there were 80 people representing the top level of 3,200 people in the ILO secretariat. In that room, there were 79 men and one woman. I couldn't believe my eyes. Here, this institution created by Treaty of Versailles, talking about the workers of the world when at least 53% of the workers of the world were women, were totally unrepresented at the senior level of the ILO. So I decided on the spot that I had to change that. So how do you go about changing an institution that was created in 1919 and was in its second and third generation of secretariat people, all men? Well, I decided that what I wanted to do was to create a bureau, a major office on women in the ILO, and make them responsible for reviewing all of the technical assistance projects that the ILO generated over the years to ensure that the role of women was an active factor in that technical assistance project. But how to bring this about was the key issue. I finally wrote up all the resolutions that were required, and I knew that the governing body, which was the key a part of the ILO, would meet three or four times a year, of labor, management, and government. Remember, the ILO is tripartite, so all three areas had to agree on things. I knew that they were not aware of this inequity. And my idea was to take this resolution to the governing body and then on to the annual conference, which took place in June every year in Geneva. But I had a major hurdle to overcome, and that was my boss. He was a director general, and he was a Frenchman. So I pondered on how I could bring this to his attention. And I finally thought I had the key phrase. So I went in with all my papers, and I said, "Mr. Director General, how would you like to be viewed as a hero in the eyes of the women of the world?" Well, you tell a Frenchman that, you get his attention. And I got his attention. And I told him about these inequities and what my plans were. And I said, what I want to do is to take this through the governing body, through the annual meeting, and then at the end of that June meeting, where this was June of 1975, I said on the 1st of July, 1975, in Mexico City, is the first ever conference on women and development in the history of the world. And I said, I want your representative to go there and within the first hour of that World Conference on Women announced that the ILO has created the first bureau on women in the history of the United Nations system. He thought that was a great idea, and that's exactly what happened. We achieved our goal. May I now introduce my co-chair, please.
Thank you, Ambassador. It is indeed a great pleasure to be here from Geneva, Switzerland, and to speak about a concept that actually grew out of the group of the Committee on the Status of Women. And I might mention that our president is Krishna Abdul-Patel, who also worked at the ILO at the time when they were writing the gender equity agreements. Just thought I would mention that because I think it's very apropos. It's been most exciting to be part of this new group and this movement of peace mapping. The idea of peace mapping was developed in a very tiny task force of the Working Group on Peace. This task force was assigned to look at the concept of peace. And after reviewing all of the maps that we could find, we found there were no peace maps. Nothing to measure or track what was happening in this arena of the world. And yet, women are very involved in terms of war and conflict, and they're often the ones on the front line and quite affected. So this project was presented for the first time at the conference called Women Defending Peace, an ILO conference in Geneva on November 2004. And it was adopted as a plan of action. And I'd like to read that because it talks about to prepare a map of peace, we need to identify the locations of ongoing activities involving women defending peace, from establishing early warning networks that track trouble spots and dangerous situations, in engaging in a dialogue with those who have political, economic, or media power, from ensuring no less than 40% participation of women at the negotiating table. And this initiative, the Map of Peace, would track all such endeavors and resources directed to this area. I brought a PowerPoint, but also I felt it was very important because of the way that we're collecting data presently to also have a woman from the grassroots come and talk to you a bit about the many factors that are involved in conflict management. Strategists have been very keen on mapping war and conflicts and disasters through counting soldiers, ammunition, military bases, etc. Numerous maps assess these, and they talk about casualties and destruction and the needs that come out of war. But so far, we've only been confronting situations where there was not peace. So peace, consequently, has not received the attention that it deserves. And no one can ever argue that peace, in many ways, has been reflected as a distorted reality. And this project is to develop a new paradigm in quantifying and looking at peace from a different basis, from the community. The proposal strives to establish a new vision and framework for addressing peace and contributing to the process of measuring successes and achievements at the global scale, and to see what kinds of obstacles are preventing the maintenance of peace. So the objective, first of all, is to create a mapping system for women and men, partners for peace, to raise a true awareness and a visibility of peace. This includes collecting data, and we have started this process, to measure and study the achievements, particularly of women in building peace, because oftentimes these women are not at the peace table when peace is brokered and negotiated after the end of a war. Also, we wanted to enhance networking, facilitate networking among peacemakers. We have many peacemakers. And then in the process of this, we wanted to create new tools for peace and an educational two-piece of the lessons learned, the best practices and guidelines, and then from that offer a platform for the development of peace. Now, in this world and in this methodology, we first want to look at two methods that have been proven over time. One is epidemiology, and the other is the military strategy. Epidemiology of war peace consists of a metaphor of health being peace, to help you understand this, disease being an epidemic or war. There's many similarities between the concept of health and disease and peace and war. The methods to tackle disease and epidemics have proven very efficient in the world, but have also shown that the maintenance of health peace needs really require constant surveillance, reviewing and assessment of what is happening in the intervention. Health as peace is not a static and frozen state of being, but a continuous study of health determines there are determinants of health, risk of morbidity, and mortality to understand the multiple causes affecting health. Thereby, in peace, it's the same approach to develop peace determinants, peace degradation. There might be multiple causes in an area that might jeopardize peace and impede the strategies to keep promoting peace in an area. And this concerns the individual, the family, and the community, and finally the nation and the governance. Now, the military strategy also is involved in this because one of the most important tools for military strategies is MAPS, and a very structured and organized plan to achieve their aim. Both of these methods really reinforced each other, and this is what we have moved ahead on. The agents of change of the community is to give voice to the voiceless, and in peace, this is paramount, because particularly women have been voiceless in this process. Women and mothers, grandmothers, are a special target group. And throughout the world, women have been at the front lines of conflicts and violence. Several women non-governmental organizations at the UN are truly committed to make such a change. And I think the question and the records of such achievements of men and women is that what we need to know from the civil society viewpoint in terms of peace and getting to the point where peace mapping becomes a reality to help those in the world to understand what in their community is involved in keeping peace a steady factor in their everyday life. And so I am very pleased to introduce one of the women involved in this. Her name is Carol Ugachukwu. She is a woman from Nigeria. She is the president of the worldwide organization Africa for Women. And she also has received from her Ibu tribe, in recognition of the great contributions she's made, the Chieftaincy Award. And she is going to talk to you about some of the things that we have been doing, particularly at this first stage of collecting data and helping those in a community to evaluate what is going on in their own individual culture and community. And I'd like to present Chief Carol Ugachukwu from Nigeria.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is it on? Is it on? Thank you, Afton, for that nice introduction and for your kind words. In talking about peace, I would first of all give my own experience from living in a war. I come from Nigeria, Eastern Nigeria, and came from that group that were involved in war from 1967 to 1970. And then I was a college student in my last years in college. And so we had to... Everything was disrupted. We left the university. We all ran to the bush, and we remained in the bush for 3 years. We were deprived of so many things that we took for granted. The most important object at that time for families became just a simple item on the table salt to eat. So people don't find even salt to add to their food. And we learned how important salt was. So now in my family, we keep bags of salt so that we make sure we don't run out of it in case of any problem. Then going back to what we have. What I've been told to talk about, it's about the community, living in the community, and how, what we do to make sure that we have peace. In my place, we have a saying. We say, if you eat your corn and I eat my corn, there's no conflict. But there is no peace. That is how we as Africans perceive peace. Because when you eat your corn and I eat mine, you are on your own. To your tent, O Israel, you are on your own. But when we eat, you eat your corn, you bring your own, you eating and I'm eating, then we are sharing. We come together, we show love. We work together for a common good, a common goal. Then that is what we perceive as peace in my own community. So I live in a community that is rural with the villagers. And I am going to tell you what we do. First of all, my community is so well organized. And I am proud to say that. We have, first, the Council of Elders. The Council of Elders, the traditional ruler is in charge. And then we have only men, all the men from the various representatives on that Council of Elders. But it happened that for one reason or the other, they put me on that council. That's the first time a woman is on that council. Then I sit along with them. Then we have another group, Council of another elders, but this time these are seasoned, older people that have been proved to be of high integrity. That say nothing but the truth. Then we have what we call umwada, ladies, women born into the village but married outside the village, married to other places. These are daughters of the village. These daughters are very formidable and people fear them for what they stand for. Then we also have the youth, the age grades. We have what we call people age grades. We have age grades. How do we determine age grades? We do that people born within 3 years, children born within three years are members of an age grade. I belong to my own age grade. I was born at a certain time, whatever was remarkable. At that time, that's determined to your age grade. I'm not going to give out my age here. So, but then that gives a name to the age grade. So I belong to my age grade. And what we do is we focus on development of our community because most of the time the governments, though may be willing, but not all the time, do things for those people in the villages. So if you don't help yourself, nobody will help you. So we have this attitude of helping ourselves. My husband's age grade, for instance, they built the post office for the community. My age grade built a secondary school. So we have age grades, the ones living in the U.S., some of them now, their age grade, they are building a library. So these are the things we do to help ourselves according to age grades. Then this is also how we keep peace. We respect our elders. When as you get older, the better it becomes. For me now in my community, I was telling my friend that I feel so happy. I just came a week ago from my community. The respect, the way people treasure you, the way people want to know, when will I get to your age? What did you do to get to, you know, to get to where you are. You just get so much respect, so much attention that you feel, oh, it's good to be older. But it's only when you get sick that you say, okay, no, maybe we remove some of those ones, but it's really good to be older. And so in my community, when there is a dispute, what we do is we get the elders, you report to your own immediate village, they look at it. If it's very serious, you refer it to the next level. We have levels of leadership in the community, well organized. And then if it's so tough that those people cannot do much, then we call the daughters of the land. Those ones, they are involved in disputes, conflict resolution, that is not murder. Only when somebody is murdered that we involve any other higher authority. Otherwise, we settle everything within our village. And they come there dispassionately, look at the problems, and their verdict is like the jury system here. No appeal. When the daughters say, this is it, you are wrong. This is it. Nobody says no. It's the jury has spoken, and so be it. And most of the time, they are very dispassionate, they are honest, they give a right judgment. This is how we operate that's how we resolve our conflicts, within ourselves, with our system set in place. If you are against it, then you are excommunicated from the village. For instance, if you commit murder in my village, and even when the courts sentence you or they find a way of getting themselves out, you are excommunicated for 7 years. You cannot come there. You cannot. So these are the things, some of the things we do. And I know I have little time, but all I'm saying is that we, in our own primordial society, those that where we live, we don't have a lot, but we have ourselves. We have the love. We have respect that we have. These are the things we do. And then we have organized women worldwide organization to have programs, projects to help themselves so that they don't look for handouts. And you will be surprised that $30, $20 has made a lot of difference in the lives of these women. Afton has been to my village 2 times, and each time she goes there, it's better, because the women with $20 gift, they have been able to come out of, I may say, poverty in our own way, not what you perceive here, can feed their family, can do a lot, can trade. They are doing so much. And all I can say is that we know we have problems with the leadership in Africa. People want to stay for life and all that. But the people the people themselves are helping themselves. And the thing I observe about this conference, if I didn't know Afton and we don't work together, we wouldn't have known this important program, the culprits are in Africa. When I was younger, we used to use banana leaf to do many things, to tie, to cook our so many delicacies, to wrap them as the wrapping sheet, to wrap things. But now we use plastic for everything. And nothing, they don't recycle, nothing. So everything, it's just degrading the earth. And all that, nobody cares about so many things. So how does this conference, the message of what is being said that I've been opportune to hear, get to the people of Africa? I wonder how. Maybe somebody will tell me at the end of this. But one thing I know is that out of the darkest cloud, there is always the brightest star. Because I live in Africa and we play by the moonlight and we know without electricity. And I know that that brightest star may be this conference, this symposium. And I hope and I wish that the message, the things we receive from here, all the good talks we hear, this message will be the bright star, the brightest star that will go and brighten Africa and the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much for your presentations. Carol, you'll be interested to know that the village approach that you have described, unfortunately, does not work in the Port Harcourt area of Nigeria. My Institute for Multi-Track Diplomacy has been involved in trying to reduce the conflict because of the youth and the violence that they have been carrying out in frustration because they have not been heard by the oil companies or by the local government. So we have been instrumental in creating a peace forum and have just opened an office in Port Harcourt last week to try to help to give the boys in the creek a voice to be heard. And now we're trying to interact with the government and the oil companies to see if we can bring forward some development projects to help them in that particular area. The second part of our panel has to do with the humanitarian response. And before I pass the microphone to our next speaker, I want to tell you another story. After World War II, the United States was the only military force that had the airlift capacity to respond immediately to natural disasters around the world. And the Pentagon got very high marks for almost 25 years for the work that they did in helping people who were involved in, unfortunately, in major national disasters around the world. But toward the end of the 1960s and the 1970, other nations became involved because they were developing similar airlift capacities, and so the Soviets and French and the British all got involved in the same effort. There was no coordination whatsoever, and there was no particular knowledge of what the needs were of the particular country at that particular point in time. So when there was chaos on the ground, and so I thought maybe there was some way that we could help to change that and to make order out of chaos. But I had the problem of trying to convince the Pentagon that they should allow other people, including the United Nations, to play a major role in this area. So what I did was to keep a record of three or four natural disasters where the Pentagon had arrived second or third in time, and I proved that they were losing money on this because their hospital that they had flown in was the second one and only one was needed. And I finally convinced them that it was a wise move if we could create a coordinator for natural disasters. And so I proceeded to get the United Nations involved, and in early 1971, we were able to pass a resolution creating the Office of the Disaster Relief Coordinator, which was located in Geneva, Switzerland at the time. And they did bring about order where chaos had existed. They also went out and trained people in countries which were disaster-prone countries, like Turkey with earthquakes and so forth. And they got governments to pre-position supplies and so forth so that it became a little bit more efficient than it had been in the past. And with that little introduction, let me pass the microphone to Lee from the State Department, who you met earlier this morning, who will talk more in detail about this issue. Please.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Ambassador MacDonald. And I'd also like to thank Tim Forsman in particular for inviting me to speak here. Tim has been working in various capacities, both personally and professionally, with our office at the State Department for the better part of two decades, and we always appreciate his ideas and his efforts, and also Glenn Lauder for helping to put together the panel. It's humbling to be invited to speak at a symposium whose goal, as reiterated by the ambassador, is to help ensure the future of humanity and peace on the planet. The program originally had me listed first, and I was kind of hoping to be followed by my fellow panelists who would talk about peace mapping, because it seems that everything that my office is involved with seems to be the most intractable of conflicts in the world, and it tends to be a depressing message, but so be it. I have 20 minutes, I believe, to speak, and I will stick to that, and I'm going to be talking about some of the GIS and remote sensing applications primarily at the State Department that my office is involved in, a little bit about the office, and some observations and recommendations on how to improve that type of work and to better the delivery of humanitarian assistance and to better the plight of those suffering from human rights violations and natural disasters and the like. Just very briefly, my office is the Office of the Geographer and Global Issues. It's grown exponentially over the past decade, largely because of the use of digital information, both imagery analysis and GIS, computer cartography. The two units that are highlighted in blue are mostly technical units. We have a group called the Humanitarian Information Unit, which is a relatively new division in the office that is focused primarily, or I should say exclusively, on unclassified information so that it can share with organizations like the United Nations, with NGOs and the like. And the issues we work on, as you can see from the Multilateral and Transnational Issues Division and the War Crimes Atrocities Analysis Division, are central to the efforts by the Department of State and the international organizations and NGOs to facilitate humanitarian relief around the world. A little bit of history. The office used to be involved in very traditional geographic research, primarily on the creation, verification of new boundaries with the volatility of World War I and World War II and decolonization, and then the law of the seas, treaties, maritime boundaries. So for about a 30 or 40-year period, the office was involved in traditional geographic research on world boundaries. And as the world's boundaries became more or less defined and codified and demarcated, our shift began to be on issues at the Department of State that did not fit neatly into regional stovepipes, but that crossed boundaries. So we work on a lot of trans-boundary issues, if you will, refugees, human rights, international organizations, environment, sustainable development, a lot of these issues that lend themselves to global mapping efforts, which became sort of the focus of how we provided a lot of the information that we give to the policymakers at the State Department and that we try to share with as many different partners, both in U.S. government, other governments, and non-governmental organizations as well. At the end of the day, though, geospatial data provides the core of what we do. We gather information from all sources, though my office happens to be located in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department. I would say probably 80% of the work we do is on unclassified information. And one of the great challenges we have that I'll get into is we tend to work on a global scale in areas of the world that are very remote, that are prone to complex emergencies and natural disasters. I'm constantly frustrated by vendors who are coming by and demoing new applications and new software packages using data from San Diego when we're dealing in places of the world where we don't have nearly the robust data sets to make canned demos work as well, and we're scrambling around to find out mostly what we don't know. Oops. Very briefly, despite all the work of my humble office at the State Department to push geospatial technologies, at the State Department, the written word still rules. It's very much still a memo and cable organization, databases, maps, interactive collaborative tools, and all the things that most of this audience, people in this audience, are quite familiar with, remain foreign to many of the people at the State Department, and that is why we try to attach as many maps and imagery analyses to the work we do and provide a means to disseminate those types of products throughout the department. All right. Now you know a little bit about what the office does. I'm going to talk about specifically how we work on humanitarian crises, and also I'm going to touch on human rights work as well, because the two tend to be very much tied together. Most human rights violations in the world are taking place in places where there's ongoing conflict or chronic emergencies or peacekeeping operations or complex humanitarian emergencies. So human rights and humanitarian relief are very closely tied together in terms of the analytical approach we have to using GIS and remote sensing tools. And as any of you who were here this morning heard me, I'm constantly cautioning our community. When I say our community, I talk about mostly the GIS and remote sensing community for sort of what I call an overindulgence on self-congratulation. Usually it's GIS geeks at headquarters talking to GIS geeks in the field. They want to find out if a product was useful. They say, oh, yes, it was very useful. We all used it. And when you end up talking to the first-time responders and the people who are planning a lot of the logistics, trying to locate vulnerable populations, trying to figure out where bridges are out, very often these tools are not provided in a timely fashion, are not in an appropriate format, are not disseminated appropriately, and a lot of opportunities are lost. But that being said, I think what needs to be understood and realized by the GIS and remote sensing community is that even if they are not involved in first-time response to the extent that perhaps they could be with better training and better understanding of such tools in the field, getting in early and organizing your data appropriately and linking it with relief agencies' priorities will have a tremendous impact on the follow-up that takes place to any humanitarian emergency, that is reconstruction activities, rehabilitation activities, establishing good governance, reestablishing trade routes, if you will, that most of these complex emergencies involve countries that are broken down, have little or no governmental effectiveness, and by getting early after a crisis with appropriate tools, don't worry about congratulating yourself necessarily on saving lives that you didn't save, but understand that you're providing a foundation level of data in situations where there are no legacy systems to get in the way, actually, and can provide a tremendous boost to follow-up efforts. And I always have to highlight the fact that no matter how robust the data are that we're providing, there's a critical importance of field work and ground truth to virtually any effort that is undertaken. Moving into some examples now of the work that our office is involved in. We work very closely with the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. I have seven of their geospatial analysts that are detailed to my office. The senior NGA representative to the State Department sits right down the hall from me, as does the senior representative to the State Department from the U.S. Geological Survey. So we integrate with our partners. So we have a DOD civil affairs officer in my office. We have a USAID disaster relief specialist. So it's very much an interagency effort, much as a lot of the tools we're using are interdisciplinary. But what's critical in a lot of the early warning efforts for crisis planning is to identify areas where there may be a crisis, to go out to those areas and capture information before the crisis hits. Because if you wait until the crisis hits, usually what happens is a lot of good information, a lot of a lot of historical knowledge, a lot of the NGOs working in the area, a lot of the university holdings disappear. So we work on a series of what we call humanitarian reference maps on areas where we're anticipating future crises. We do this in coordination with the UN OCHA, which is the successor to Department of Humanitarian Affairs with a humanitarian coordinator. We do that in coordination with NGOs and the intelligence community to try to anticipate the next event. Of course, anticipating the next event is not always easy. Critical importance of ground truth, one obvious example, landmine risk maps. Some of the frustrations we have in landmine risk data is disseminating this information to NGOs in the field. We know for a fact that there are humanitarian workers who are out in areas that are working, that have considered those areas clear of landmines or have been cleared of landmines. But what organization has a responsibility to disseminate this information to let everyone know it's safe? It's usually done by the United Nations, and the United Nations will not do this unless they have a verifiable means of capturing the data in a consistent way by reliable organizations with good training. So this is a challenge in, again, organizing your systems and databases. You're out in the field, you talk to people, you say, oh, it's fine to go through this area. My cow goes all over that pathway. And yet, if you don't have a way to get that information effectively to the organization that's organizing relief, that road will be considered a no-go by international agencies, and they won't be able to use it for delivering road assistance as well. So not just ground truth, but a way to systematically collect that information in standardized format and disseminate it as well. I always enjoy showing this map of Afghanistan when the irrigation systems throughout the country were completely destroyed after the Taliban, except for one region in Helmand province. It doesn't take a genius to figure out this is the poppy-producing region where the irrigation systems were intact. It was a remote area that was still undergoing some fighting, and yet this was one area where you could rely fairly instinctively on what the imagery showed you. Another challenge is knowing where we need to focus imagery assets because it's very challenging for an imagery analyst to search for certain factors on the ground, be they military formations or destroyed villages or airplanes at certain airports. And so we need to do a better job of directing the resources so that we can narrow the focus of what information. We have a comparative advantage in the U.S. government for identifying and targeting imagery as opposed to just searching for a needle in a haystack. One example of a project that should just be out now in glossy format produced by the National Research Council, the National Academy of Sciences, is a Populations at Risk Information Project, which our office co-sponsored with a number of other different federal agencies precisely to use existing scientific, mostly geospatial tools combined with survey information, census data, estimative techniques, and the like to get finer scale population estimates in parts of the world that are prone to disasters. Very much a challenge. I used the example this morning about the fact that we're very good at counting refugees and displaced persons, but we don't have a very good idea of the resident populations in large parts of the world. The idea is to empower a U.S. government agency to work on a list of priorities developed at the interagency process so that you then have a surge capacity to move to an area of the world that may not be on that priority list if a humanitarian crisis occurs. And as most of you probably are well aware, the priority list of where to focus some collection assets are not always in the regions, particularly in African areas that may not be the most considered the most nationally strategic for U.S. foreign policy goals or anti-terrorism efforts or a number of other traditional priorities. And we need to have a surge capacity to at least move into those areas when conflict does break out. We work on education and training. to promote best practices, to make people understand that it's not necessarily the tool that matters in terms of collecting information, whether you use a stubby pencil behind your ear or whether you use the most sophisticated geographic information system and imagery analysis. If you don't collect the information based on common sets of definitions, if you don't have the place names consistent, the information will get lost and eventually you'll lose the ability to provide assistance in a timely manner. We provide support to the UN and other agencies in times of disaster. Here's a we provided an atlas in Aceh in Indonesia shortly after the tsunami hit. We also worked to develop an interagency working group to push imagery out to the field. The Defense Department declassified all of the imagery that they had available, but ironically, a lot of this imagery was in a format that couldn't be used, that couldn't be delivered. And at the end of the day, all it took was a prop plane flying along the coast of Aceh to show that all of the bridges were out, not a national technical means imagery analysis that took, you know, several days to map out that, oh, by the way, all of the bridges are out. So it's always a challenge to figure out what your priorities are. We had someone else go out after the Pakistan earthquake, another example of reaching back into national assets to get imagery analysis, where sometimes we get higher resolution imagery that cannot be shared or declassified, but the analysis from that imagery can be shared. This is just the type of arrangement we worked on the destroyed and damaged villages in Darfur with NGA, and very often the U.S. government is being pounded on by the UN NGOs to release high-resolution imagery when, in reality, what might be just as useful is the analysis from that imagery. Each of these regions, by the way, has very high-resolution, large-scale analyses attached with them. That's just a summary document here. For a current example, we worked fairly heavily providing GIS analysis following the Israel-Lebanon conflict on a number of issues that the State Department policymakers were interested in. This is another example of damage to roads and bridges. This is all imagery-derived damage where we were able to, at least in Lebanon, where we had a lot of UN and civilian workers and the like in the field, check a lot of this information on Ground Truth. Here's an example of a product that was, again, use of GIS to show the impact of unexploded ordnance on agricultural sector in southern Lebanon, buffering each of the points of unexploded ordnance. But at the end of the day, this product never went anywhere because when we talk to people in the field, yeah, there may have been unexploded ordnance there, but then, you know, what usually happens if anybody's in the field is unexploded ordnance, they pick it up, they bring it over into a pile, they stack it somewhere, and they go ahead and they plow their fields, where you can get all sorts of information as to where the ordnance may have landed, but in reality, it's not disrupting the agricultural sector, particularly in this case, as much as one may think of an analysis. Just some more examples of field efforts we've had. We had a very basic but successful effort of pulsing back georeferenced information from Iraq to our office and producing maps and sending it back out into the field, what the Defense Department calls situational awareness, working with the military to make them understand that if they're the first ones into an area, that they can also provide information on humanitarian circumstances and not just on war fighting. We've been very successful getting cooperation with them. Providing information prior to attacks on facilities that need to be protected, hospitals, schools, very challenging also to get precise information in this type of an effort. This was an example, a very successful example of a very, very simple tool that was very successful when we had a small Marine contingent that was going to secure some UN warehouses in Monrovia, and we knew that the warehouse district was in here, but we didn't know exactly which warehouses were full of of grain. WFP and all the other NGOs evacuated very quickly. So we just did a simple PowerPoint slide, sent it to the WFP's 24-hour headquarters in Rome, and somebody there knew which warehouses had the grain. They sent it back to us. It was sent out to the Marines, and very, very simple tools sometimes is the best solution. We've had a couple of missions go out to the Horn of Africa because it is a chronic emergency that has lots of information, particularly even in a place like Somalia, where ironically, precisely, I think in part because there is no government, that the NGO and UN infrastructure is very strong there. And the question there is the challenge of coordinating a lot of this information and directing it and prioritizing it, whether it's going to be a drought or a locust infestation or a flood. You never really know how to anticipate those types of crises. Everyone here is, I'm sure, familiar with the concept of an enterprise GIS, linking database to destroyed villages in Kosovo, tied in with imagery that was flown U2 that could be declassified, and then producing a summary map that was very influential in convincing NATO at that time to conduct a bombing attack, because it showed that the cleansing that was taking place was not random and it was more heavily directed at the ethnic Albanian population in Kosovo. I'm not going to get into Darfur. I've got tons of information on the work we've done in Darfur, but there have been a number of examples throughout the course of this session. But I think I'll just end with the at least as far as my imagery goes, that it's important not just to display the fact that there are horrific events going on in the world, but, and this is getting into the human rights angle of my comments, very frequently we have NGOs and the UN and journalists coming to our office trying to convince us that horrible things are happening in a place like Darfur. And my response is always that you don't have to convince us that horrible things are happening, but they need to be documented in a way that is systematic, that can hold up to scrutiny, that can be used for court proceedings, that can be tied to a perpetrator if they're being used for criminal prosecutions, that just having a randomly generated set of horrible stories doesn't help in the determination of genocide and the accountability of perpetrators. But those who have the proper tools in the field, particularly GIS databases and if they're being used broadly enough and if information is being protected appropriately, then a lot of grassroots human rights organizations don't realize the power they have to share information, aggregate it, and still protect the individual's rights to anonymity and protect them from retributions and the like. This is a real challenge that we're working on training with a lot of human rights agencies. Let me just skip through the Darfur images here that you've probably seen elsewhere and end with a couple of recommendations. Sorry about that. It's a product we did on documenting atrocities in Sudan, which was eventually used by the Secretary of State when he declared genocide. Just some recommendations. The appropriate use of information here. This is mostly for human rights collection. You have to educate the first responders as to their not only their ability but their responsibility to put together information that can be used for uses that they may not be cognizant of in the narrow mission that many agencies have, and that we need to move from public awareness to accountability. Always in the areas we work on, data are the limiting factor, duplication of data, the expense of data production, the delivery of data, the difficulties of maintaining changes over time in a consistent global basis, and that these are ways that geographers can contribute to a better understanding of applications. If we are on the ground floor of collection strategies, if we can gain early access and disseminate early access, again, we don't know often what we know, and if we can provide the information in a way that decision makers view the use of graphic tools as a powerful part of their diplomatic toolkit. So basically, good geointelligence equals compatible geodata, maps, imagery, ground truth, metadata, analysis, and dissemination delivery. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that presentation. I think you all recognize by now that he is the point man of the State Department who understands what you're talking about. And I think that you should all use his good offices to have access to the leadership at the State Department, because this link between what you're doing and what the policymakers are doing is an important bridge that he is traveling every day. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Lars, who has spoken twice before and about Darfur, and I think now you're going to talk more about the human rights itself. Is that correct?
Yeah. I'll be talking about my whole general project. Thank you, Ambassador McDonald, Madam Co-Chair. Thanks to the conference organizers for letting me come here and speak. I really appreciate it. I wanted to talk, of course, about human rights and spatial technology. I work for an organization, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Just in case you don't know everything about AAAS, here's my brief background slide. We were founded in 1848. We're the world's largest general science society. We're the folks who publish Science Magazine. In addition to our membership and publishing side of things, we have many grant-funded science and policy activities, which includes a long-standing science and human rights program. This program got started in the 70s, working on things like survey methodologies for human rights organizations, forensic science applications, statistical applications, and several things along those lines. For about the last year, I've had the privilege of working on a project funded by the MacArthur Foundation, which is generally in the vein of the science and human rights program. It is the Geospatial Technologies and Human Rights Project. And through this project, AAAS is basically exploring NGO applications of geospatial technologies to human rights work. If you heard Tim Forstman's opening comments yesterday about the role NGOs can play, which is different than the role governments can play, that really summarized nicely what we're all about. We really feel that NGOs have a very powerful role to play in human rights work around the world, and that geospatial technologies in general can really promote that mission. Specifically, things like how satellite imagery and the related technologies can be applied to human rights work within specific contexts, what organizations or individuals are actively developing such applications or have done so in the past. It's important to note, of course, that we are not the first folks to do this. Several people have been doing this both inside and outside government for quite some time, actually. But our goal is to basically draw their information together, figure out what's going on, document it, get it up on our website so other human rights organizations can make use of this. Basically, how can we draw all this together to improve the information system supporting NGO human rights work is kind of the sum total there. In case you're wondering what human rights are when we use that term, we generally identify those within the they're generally identified within the 1948 UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. These are things like your civil and political right to be alive and to express yourself and things like that. Also, economic rights, access to resources. Some of these are also embodied and described in the Geneva Conventions that you hear about. That's where we get into things like genocide and prisoner of war treatment and stuff like that. And also defined by many national and regional agreements, laws, etc. We in the United States have a very robust legal framework that protects our rights for the most part. And so the violations to human rights generally occur in the context of these legal agreements. So when we talk about NGO work on human rights issues, it generally at some level gets back to a legal case or a law of some sort. The goal of our project is to not become another human rights organization, basically. There's already more than enough of those, I'm sure. And so we seek to basically plug into what they basically what they do and provide the geospatial technology support and methodological development to those organizations. So just a quick survey of the folks that we talk to on a regular basis includes Amnesty International, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, Human Rights Watch are kind of some of the bigger ones, smaller groups like a group in Colombia called
called Akitas, a group, the U.S. Campaign for Burma, that works on Burmese issues, Mekong Watch, the Harvard Law School, and a whole bunch of others. We basically view these as a distributed information network out there that we need to figure out how to best take advantage of within the geospatial context and provide services to. How did we get started on this project? Basically, my organization and myself had experience with geospatial data and digital earth concepts for quite some time within standard environmental studies, environmental science, and other sorts of scientific studies. Also, the 2004 U.S. government assessment of genocide in Darfur did, at a certain level, make use of commercial imagery, and that really exemplified the potential of the commercial satellite imagery sector for this sort of work. We kind of looked at each other and said, why isn't there more going on in this area? We also reviewed work done previously by Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and others, such as a gentleman here named Matthew McKenzie, who's been working on this for quite some time. And we just basically got the idea that we could do more on this, and we pitched the idea to the MacArthur Foundation, and they basically went for it. So the main challenges in this sort of work are assessing how the spatial data and tools can complement existing information networks. We view these organizations as a fantastic information network, and how do we really complement them? At the same time, the cost can be high, the computing requirements can be very significant, so how do we minimize that or essentially provide services in those areas? So even kind of a small two-person human rights NGO is one step away from a satellite because they know us or they know of us, or they know people who know us, et cetera, et cetera. AAAS's general modus operandi is to do things like develop professional networks and organizational planning resources, so there's an element of that in there as well. And the bottom line is basically, how do we produce results on this? This stuff is expensive, it's time-consuming. How do we turn it into actionable intelligence, airtight documentation for legal work? How do we actually come up with impact for this? It's great stuff to work on, but if it's not really impacting the situation on the ground at the end of the day, then obviously those considerable funds might be better applied somewhere else. So far, for about the last year and most heavily over the last 6 months, high-resolution imagery has been our main focus. We really want to wrap this issue up, basically. We analyze high-res imagery for directly observable features such as destroyed homes, bomb craters, missing towns, things like that. Image pairs showing the before and the after conditions of a particular location tend to be especially critical. Those really tell the story very well. However, only a tiny fraction of the Earth is imaged each day. Clouds often interfere. So this is kind of a very slow way of getting things done. You're not, it is imagery on demand on one level, but it's a slow process, or it can be a slow process. But we basically want to create this human rights observing system, and we see this growing human rights observing system, both using high-res imagery and then some of the lower-resolution, more research-oriented satellites. If you want more on that concept, you can see the Imaging Notes article that we wrote for the issue that's been passed out fairly heavily here at this conference. And when we use observing system in this context, we use it kind of in the classic observing system context. We really want this to be kind of a 24/7 constellation of sensors that are available at any given time to document things going on the ground. We're not just going to focus on high-res imagery, of course. We're also interested, but haven't had much time to work on it yet, things like correlating some smaller, more local issues, for example, waste processing facilities and ethnic groups. There's a great study that was done on the relationships between the two in the Bronx, and I think there's a lot of potential in there to basically take that concept and expand it elsewhere. Patterns and trends of persecution across wide areas, and then possible precursors to violence, which is a key issue, which might lead us to early warning systems, which might lead us to prevention, which is really a good thing to go after. And there's, of course, much more in there. Products that we will get to in the foreseeable future are things like incorporating GIS and other tools into locating clandestine graves or mass graves. That's something that we're working on with NGO groups who are interested in this issue, specifically in Colombia and to a lesser extent Afghanistan. They know what they're doing, but how would a GIS sort of methodology really complement their work? Also, things like cadastral surveys to basically map where displaced populations regulations used to be. So if you were going to come up with a fair compensation package for displaced populations, what sort of geospatial products might you base that on? Also, applying socioeconomic census-based analysis to human rights work. So this would get into the area of what we refer to generally as vulnerability analysis, but really looking at the human rights component of that. And then since census products don't really exist for much of the world, how do you create census-like products from rapid sampling efforts done by groups on the ground? Why do we do all this? Basically because we feel this data and the satellite imagery can really assist with the monitoring, advocacy, and legal efforts of a lot of these organizations. It can also inform mission planning, situational awareness when they need to know what's going on in remote, difficult-to-reach areas. Also, we feel that it's a very fragmented field, human rights work, but if we can facilitate information sharing and common information sources on crisis areas, maybe all these groups will just kind of work in concert by virtue of the fact that they're all drawing from the same information sources. And that's really a critical question to get at. How do we get everyone to share information while still preserving confidentiality and all those very important aspects of the work? And essentially, how do we link these wide networks of NGO contacts with authoritative, objective data and information, whether it's satellite-based or otherwise? So basically, how we've gone about this over the last year or so is we've started compiling information on applications and methods, and a lot of this has made it to our website. A lot more needs to make it to our website. We are behind on that. I apologize. We're getting to it. And basically, we're working with these organizations to really understand what is their information infrastructure and how can we complement it. And they do, I mean, they have very sophisticated information infrastructure. It's pretty amazing what tools they make use of. But there are certain things missing. So what do we need to step in and provide on that level? And we basically engage in numerous case studies with specific sets of partners. I'm going to talk about some of these, including Zimbabwe and Burma, and then a little bit on Darfur in Eastern Chad, because we've talked a lot about that already. In Zimbabwe in particular, just to give you the background, in 2005, the government of Zimbabwe oversaw the demolition of thousands of homes of opposition supporters in opposition areas. This was, of course, challenged in the in an African court, the African Court on Human and People's Rights, by a group, a very brave group called the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights. This effort was supported by Amnesty International, who kind of brokered the whole arrangement and worked with all of us to make this effort happen. And the AAAS task on this was acquiring high-resolution satellite imagery showing before and after conditions of locations that were demolished as part of this campaign. Really, the tough part of this sort of work is just locating some of these areas. You're generally talking about informal settlements in a developing country. As Lee mentioned, there's not exactly a robust mapping system going on that the outside world can really access readily. Often these informal settlements have the same names as nearby formal settlements, which make it even more difficult. And the houses are generally quite small, so you can't just kind of scan MODIS data or Landsat data to find these things. 48 square meters is kind of a typical size. So how did we actually find some of our locations? We made maps. Basically, we compile maps based on freely available data, and this is an example. A PDF map that we mailed to some partner, emailed to some partners. So we got roads and railroads data from the Digital Chart of the World. We got all the named points from Defense Department GeoNet Names database, which is publicly accessible. And then, of course, a background satellite image from the GeoCover Landsat product, which is available from the Global Land Cover facility. We put all that together. We emailed it to the people that we were working with, and they were able, basically, we had overlaid a grid on it, so then they just gave us a grid coordinate of where these actual informal settlements were located in this particular area. They could simply indicate where this was based on those maps. Also, using the maps sometimes led us to essentially driving directions. They would say, oh, you leave the city, you drive along the road. When the lake is on your left, the town was on your right. Also, Google Earth was used by the researchers in London who knew the areas well enough that they could tell us what the coordinates were based on Google Earth. All this was basically designed to come up with the precise coordinates so we could research available imagery and task the satellites. So the four locations that we were interested in, we wanted before and after images for each, so we wanted 8 images, and we were able to get 7 of those at very low cost from archives. And then we had to task this QuickBird satellite to get 1 new image. And so the total cost of this one for the imagery itself was about $4,400, which is still a lot of money in many areas, but it does bring it in within the budget of a lot of human rights organizations. So we were pretty excited about that. This one kind of became the poster child for our project for a while. This was a town called Porta Farm in Zimbabwe. This is what it looked like in June 2002. And once it was demolished, 870 structures were removed. It's clearly gone. You can see the outlines of the roads, but very few of the structures remain, only a few of storage containers that were there. Basically, that image set was submitted by the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights to the African Court as part of their court case. That caused that court case to be postponed, as the government of Zimbabwe wanted to challenge the accuracy and validity of the images. We think that's fantastic. Please go all the way to the source, find the same images. You won't find anything wrong with it. We're not airbrushing anything. That's the beauty of this satellite technology. We verified this with Landsat data. So if they really want to argue it, before they know it, they'll be arguing again. NASA, which is kind of a nice, you know, witness to have on the stand for these folks. Also, the imagery was used in advocacy efforts, just kind of in getting the word out, and it really struck a chord. This is a relatively old issue. It's hard to get some legs on it in the media, but using satellite imagery on it just generated a very great response to it. And frankly, it made the people who were affected by this tragedy take on a great deal of hope, because they felt somehow that the outside world was actually paying attention to this, and they were just kind of blown away by the detail that we were able to offer and how quickly it was all done. I mean, we got a lot of great words of appreciation. If you know anything about legal systems anywhere, unfortunately, this stuff tends to move very slowly, so we don't really know what the actual outcome of this case is going to be, but something that we're watching closely. The Burma situation gets into some of our conflict monitoring activities, which is kind of a different animal. And to give you some context on this, in early 2006, a government offensive against the Karen people in Karen State intensified. It's been going on for quite some time. It kind of picked up steam in recent years. And this is a very closed, remote area that makes access very difficult. It's a relatively unknown issue, so advocates are generally desperate to draw attention to it. Luckily, there are several human rights and humanitarian groups that do operate in the area. They literally cross over the border and investigate and deliver supplies and bring out information. So we got a small grant from the Open Society Institute to basically attempt to quantify the destruction reported by these organizations using high-res imagery. I just wanted to mention, you know, this work isn't possible without the folks that we draw the information from. They are the agents on the ground in this case, and they're very important information sources. And they include groups like the Free Burma Rangers, the Karen Human Rights Group, the Thailand Burma Border Commission, and a group called Mekong Watch. And generally, they publish this information on their website, and we do dialogue with them. We do talk with them quite a bit. But it's amazing to think that we could do all this, you know, just kind of by reading their websites, because they document this stuff very, very completely. And so, again, all we're really bringing in is that element of tasking the satellite on what they report. So they tell us where attacks happen, and we simply work based on that. And we try and verify it again with these before and after image pairs. So we've acquired a good set of images. This has been a real tough one, though, compared to some of the other work. The monsoons, of course, cloud the area over for a good portion of the year. That causes some delay. Also, the monsoons and rapid vegetation growth really erase traces of destroyed villages, whereas in Darfur, if you destroy a village, you'll see a trace of that for many, many years. In a place like Burma, all traces wiped out pretty much after the rainy season because the vegetation grows so rapidly and the rainfall is so heavy. Also, we've discovered the villages are actually rarely razed. It's more a case where the residents are heavily harassed and driven kind of out into the hills. There are many cases of the villages actually being completely destroyed, but it's not, you know, kind of the wholesale destruction that we've seen in other parts of the world. And also, since this is, you know, a very remote area, it's a relatively unknown issue, there are relatively few archival images that we can actually draw from. We've been very lucky that GOI and their Iconos satellite had acquired a good set of images of that location from about 2002 to 2005. But still not, you know, it's not a wall-to-wall coverage, so we really have to find where attacks are happening, determine if imagery is available for those, and it's very, you know, it's a relatively small subset that we're actually able to address. And this is just one of our examples, basically. This is a village in Burma. This is an Iconos image from 2003, showing the little red dots indicate the locations of houses. And then this is a quick bird image that we tasked late last year, and it clearly shows that the village is completely gone. All the structures are gone. So this is one of several... about a dozen examples in our final report, which will which show villages that have been completely removed, wholesale removed. Also, this is one of the many military occupation camps that have now sprung up all over Karen State. And these are, you know, placed kind of smack dab in the middle of populated places. Villages are often relocated to be built around these occupation camps. The camps become holding pens for a lot of the slave labor that gets used in road construction and dam construction, and all sorts of things. And we didn't set out to document the military camps, but there just tends to be so many of them, and then they're in the areas that we're looking at, that a lot of our imagery has these occupation camps featured in them. Getting into the Darfur and Eastern Chad stuff, we've done a lot of work with Amnesty International on this. Also, of course, the Holocaust Memorial Museum and Google Earth have published great information on this, and we definitely use that in our work. And our current work with Amnesty International, you can see it, the site was just launched today, www.eyesondarfur.org. It does the usual thing of documenting specific instances of destruction, and this is also where we're trying out something that we call protective imaging, where we get reports of villages that people feel are under threat of attack, imminent attack, and we just get return visits by the satellites to acquire imagery of those locations. Amnesty builds that into an advocacy project where they say, okay, we're watching these locations on an active basis, so let's make sure they're okay. And we, you know, we're very interested in how this actually works. That could really, you know, change a lot of things in the world if the act of simply acquiring imagery of locations, building an advocacy campaign around it, actually influences events on the ground. This is our website for the AAAS project, and this is my contact information. I'm happy to talk about this more, and if you have any questions, please do let me know.
Thank you. Thank you, Lars. Your work with Amnesty on Darfur is outstanding, and certainly hope that we'll begin to move policymakers around the world. I think I'm familiar with your work in Zimbabwe, and I must say it continues to burnish the image of the AAAS, which you're a part of. Before we close our panel, I wanted to make an additional comment about something called the Global Peace Index that some of you may have heard about. But the Global Peace Index was conceived by a very wealthy Australian named Steve Kalea, who had, fortunately, the money to back up his ideas. What he wanted to do was to rank order the nations of the world by their peacefulness. So he contracted with the intelligence unit of The Economist magazine in London. I think it was a $200,000 contract, so this is a costly expenditure of his own personal funds. to make this idea happen. And then he worked with myself and Tim Forsman and Chick Dembrock of the Alliance for Peacebuilding for the last 6 months in the United States to try to expand knowledge about the fact that this was going to take place. And the actual launch was last week. It was May 30 at 9:30 in the morning at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and simultaneously it was launched in London where Steve was actually present. The head of the intelligence unit was in Washington, D.C. to answer the more difficult questions that were posted there. We had over 80 people present. It was recorded in full by C-SPAN, which has played it a number of times since that. And my latest information is that over 2,000 newspapers have carried this story all around the world. I'm pleased to report, if you're not familiar with this, that the most peaceful nation in the world is Norway. And we were able to congratulate yesterday the Consul General on the fact that his country was the most peaceful nation in the world. Also pleased to say that the second most peaceful nation in the world is New Zealand. So we're delighted to congratulate many of the people involved with this conference with the fact that you are the second most peaceful nation in the world. The third is Denmark, the fourth is Ireland, the fifth is Japan. And then you can Google them and find out what the actual list is. For many of you, perhaps would like to know what position the United States is. It's number 96 out of 121. The economist developed 24 criteria, all based on mathematics and statistical information, and they compared this over the last 6 months, had 100 people working on this whole process, and so they have a very solid base for what they believe is a very accurate definition. My goal is to have this as a major piece model where countries will look where they are on the list and then say, hey, we ought to move up a few notches. How do we go about doing it? And certainly one of the ways is the kind of things that we're talking about these last 2 days, and we'll be talking about the next 3 days. So I believe that this is something that you should know about and something that you would like to research on. Actually, we are now putting together a syllabus for a 3 hours master's degree program at least two universities have already agreed to take this on, one being the University of Peace in Costa Rica, to have a three-hour course on a study and evaluation of the techniques used in the development of this whole process. My other idea, which we're beginning to proceed with, is to rank order the 50 states of the United States in the order of their peacefulness, and that should get some interesting press attention as well. Unfortunately, in my opinion, the role of women in this process was not as strong as it should have been. So you will be pleased to know that I've already written to the Economist and to Steve Kalea, because they're going to update this annually, requesting that they have a 25th category, which would be the role of women in peace building, because I happen to believe that the women are the peace builders of the world. Thank you very much for joining us.
Focused for Dr. Schwartz, are you familiar with and can you comment on the new DOD directive 3000.05 and its implications for delivering high-resolution digital imagery to NGOs and anybody that needs it for doing reconstruction and prevention of conflict?
Yes.
Can you comment on that? Because very few people are aware of it, and I think it's very important to let people know that there is
a
policy.
The licensing agreement the DOD has now is ClearView. And actually, ClearView licensing agreement is pretty broad. That allows them to share the commercial imagery they purchase with anybody designated as a partner for U.S. interests. So, for instance, right now, if a UN or NGO were to request information from, say, my humanitarian information unit, if we can flip that around into something that is a justification that coincides with the U.S. policy priority, then that information can be shared with the NGO or any other organization. There are certain stipulations. It has to be, it's actually supposed to be destroyed after it's not being used anymore, and a few other caveats. But they've gone a long way from the Title 50 restrictions, which were limited to the pyramid of intelligence agencies. And in fact, NGA clearly refers to what they used to call commercial imagery vendors as commercial imagery partners. I'm familiar with it. I'm not sure that that many NGOs are familiar with how best to access that information, but that's how my office worked together with AAAS and Google Earth and the Holocaust Museum, was precisely on that already existing license, which is going to be even expanded further in the next licensing agreement. And it depends a lot on the budget they have for commercial imagery purchasing as well. Again, I'm not my comments here are not I'm not speaking in an official capacity here, but I'm quite familiar with the licensing agreements. Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah. Well, P3 is an easier animal to work than the. Yeah. We did the same thing in Kosovo with U2, which is easy to declassify. We had two flights run over there. So there are ways of working around it if we work together with the partners from the beginning. I think that's the real challenge. It's an education process of NGOs and other agencies to work more closely with the U.S. government, I think, on common challenges. Yeah. No, absolutely. Just don't ask me. No, I'm just kidding.
I think there's a significant role, not only that women are impacted, but also that women are natural peacemakers. And we have found in collecting data that this is the case. I feel badly because I really would have liked to have given the entire peace process, but because of the lack of time, I wasn't able to give that peace mapping presentation. So I'm going to ask the organizers if perhaps at another time in this conference I could, because it more definitely shows the role of women in this. So I think it's a very important comment. I think it's something we need to look at. And if we are going to build peace in this world, we need to enable all people, including women, to do this. Thank you.
There's another book that you should be aware of. It's called 1,000 Women for Peace. And this is an effort by the Swiss government working together with NGOs in Switzerland who have identified over the last several years 1,000 women from over 130 countries around the world. And this was all pulled together and submitted by the Swiss government for the Nobel Peace Prize of 2005. They did not receive the prize, but they produced a magnificent book, which you can get on Amazon.com, called 1,000 Women for Peace, in which it has 1,000 pages, a picture, and a full-page bio of each one of the 1,000 women. It's a fantastic document, and many of you should be aware of it. The Swiss government has now agreed to fund this modest secretariat for the next 3 or 4 years, and their goal over that period of time is to produce 10,000 women for peace. Are there other questions? Thank you very much for joining us.